Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to Tampa Bay Times features writer Stephanie Hayes. She just published her first novel titled Obituary. And yes, you heard the emphasis correctly. Stick around, but if you're a coworker of Stephanie's, or a family member, or just someone who ever called her on the phone at work, you might want to read her new novel just to see if you're recognizable as a thinly veiled character. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of not-so-carefully disguised reporter and editor stereotypes in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Sometimes I introduce my guests based on a personal experience I've had with them or their work. In the case of newspaper reporter Stephanie Hayes, I can't think of any better way to tell you what I know about her. When my mother-in-law, Helga Holsten, died 5 years ago after a long illness, Stephanie contacted my wife about writing a featured obituary. It was already a nerve-wracking time, and after being interviewed, Mimi lost quite a bit of sleep wondering what Helga's lasting legacy in print might be. See what you think. Here's the lead Stephanie wrote. Dateline St. Petersburg. People who came into the bank where Helga Holsten was a teller were sure to remember her this way. Impeccably dressed in coordinated pants outfit, laced in fine gold and gemstone jewelry, a ring on each finger. Eloquent German accent. She was always just so, everything in place, said Audrey Harris, her former co-worker at SunTrust Bank in St. Petersburg. She was so good to the customers, so compassionate. But they didn't know everything. Oh gosh, she was a remarkable lady, said Harris. She lived such a life. And that was just the beginning. And you can read the whole thing. There's a link on Mr. Media. You'll be able to read the whole thing if you're curious to see how that one goes. I just want to say that she captured my mother-in-law incredibly well for someone who had never met her. Stephanie had such a natural sense of empathy as the St. Petersburg Times obituary writer that it made her a natural for taking what could have been one of the worst beats on the newspaper and making it an envied throne of great writing and community service. So what else could she do when the time came to write her first novel than to turn all of that on its ass and portray a fictionalized version of herself, her co-workers, newspaper readers, and the recently deceased as something else altogether? In Obituary, I love saying that. It's like when I had the women on who do the diet book, Skinny Bitch. I couldn't believe I got to say bitch all the time. It was great. Anyway, in Obituary, Stephanie Hayes shows off a great and imaginative vocabulary, poking fun at everything she saw and did on her job, creating the character of Penelope Penny Perkins, an unmarried newspaper reporter, getting her first shot at the big time and, most likely, causing it all to crash down around her. This is a situation that has ongoing series written all over it, following in the footsteps, in my mind, of USA Today reporter turned novelist Deborah Sharp, author of the Mama series, including Mama Does Time and Mama Gets Hitched. Obituary would probably make a good sitcom, actually, if anyone is, you know, paying attention. Now, I will also add that in the interest of full disclosure, let me add that my wife, like Stephanie, works at the Tampa Bay Times, and Stephanie and I, interestingly enough, have the same agent. There's no connection there, but I tell you this because I trained at the Times myself, so we feel we have to get all that out on the table. Stephanie Hayes, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you. That was quite the intro.
I did warn you. We went on a little long, but yeah, you know.
I went back and reread that, the story I wrote about your mother-in-law a few days ago because I couldn't quite remember it, but I wanted to refresh on that.
Well, as I'm reading the book, I'm going, gosh, I hope this isn't going to turn up in the book. Gee, I hope this isn't going to turn up in the book. But it was so tone perfect. And the people that you talked to, I know you talked to my wife and you talked to some coworkers of my mother-in-law's, She was a very remarkable woman, and to read the obituary, it was really touching. We heard about it for weeks and months to come, and her other family members were really touched by it. So, you know.
That's good. I went back and I was like, I would have done it differently. I was picking it all apart. So, yeah, I'm glad you liked it.
Well, that's the nature of what we do. I mean, yeah. You know, I'm sure when I post this, I'll be looking at a line here and I'll go, I can't believe I said that. Well, what are you going to do? So I'm hoping you have not been hitting the Misty Mangleberry Merlot too much this morning.
A little bit. No, not this morning. I got just some regular coffee right now.
Sure you do. Sure you do. It's kind of like, you know, when you go on the talk show and everybody wants to know what Jay Leno or what are they drinking?
Ooh. Great gin.
Yeah, well, I hope not. So, look, in my experience, every journalist dreams about writing and publishing, and of course the publishing part is the hardest part, a novel, but very few pull it off. How did you make it to this point?
I think that I've always been a fiction writer ever since I was just a kid. I would write these little books for school and stuff, and it's always kind of what I wanted to do. When I got into high school, I got more into the playwriting aspect of things and screenplays, and I thought that I would be maybe a television writer for a while. And I wrote some starts to some books, and you know, when you're that young, they're terrible and they never go anywhere. And so I just kind of got, I went into junior college and I was a little bit aimless and I didn't know what I was going to do. And I thought, I was working at the mall selling CDs like Monday morning Walker Sizers, you know, it was that kind of thing. And I just thought, like, I need to write. How can I get paid to write? There has to be a way. And I thought, newspapers, they pay people to write. And so I applied for some jobs at the newspaper a few times, and then I finally got a low-level kind of editorial assistant job at the Times 10 and a half years ago. And, you know, that led me on a journalism path, which I've really, really genuinely loved and learned everything from. But there's always been this burning desire in me to still do this novel, you know, and this fiction work. And I would try things here and there off to the side, and they just wouldn't really gel. And I think that's part of the process, is you try a lot of things that go in the drawer, you know. And then I got this obit job, and I still didn't have the idea for this book, but Craig Bass, who used to work before me, he wrote the obits for the Times. He's passed away. I wrote his obit, weirdly enough, when he died.
Good man. I knew Craig.
Yeah, he was a sweetheart and a really interesting guy, and he always said, you know, before he died, he thought, I always had this idea in the back of my head for an obit writer who was a serial killer. And I went, oh. And I even told his wife that when he died, and she didn't know that. And
Joyce?
And I thought, that's such a good idea, but that's a little dark for what I don't, you know, I wouldn't do that. But I thought, well, what if you were just a regular girl who was writing obits and you accidentally killed somebody, and then you had to, you know, take over and write his story the next day? What would that be like? And that was sort of the gel for what got me thinking about the idea. And then, you know, since I was able to base it a little bit in my own experience, it came out pretty quickly. The, you know, everything just flowed, and it was the first thing that I wrote that just came out to the page, and it felt like, you know, something real.
Mm-hmm. And you also managed to get it published. You took a little different route, but
yeah. There
it is.
Yeah. So I, you know, you write the book and you think that it's, you know, you're going to be the next Dan Brown immediately. But of course that doesn't happen to anybody. And so I wrote the book, and I ended up hooking up with Distel and Goderich, the agency. And it was kind of a long story, but I got my agent for the book, you know, she loved it. And I was like, hooray, agent, you know, the rest is rocket ride to fame and fortune. Well, most people don't know that. I mean, getting the agent is really, really difficult. Most people don't know that that's just the half of it, you know, that these agents, they have a lot of manuscripts that they work really hard on. And, you know, it's really difficult to place, especially fiction right now. And fiction like I did is not necessarily quite as in demand as some of the other stuff. It's not, what I wrote is not real touchy-feely. It's not, you know, the way I look at it is chick lit that I kind of grew up reading in the mid-90s. That's kind of matured, and now those stories are, you know, they have a little older cast and they have a little more emotion behind them. And I don't, from my perspective, I don't really see anything that's replaced that you know, stuff that I grew up reading. So that's kind of what I was thinking, but that's not really in high demand right now. So we had a really hard time with it. And we just went back and forth for a while trying to figure out what to do. And I would get feedback from different publishers about, you know, some of them loved it, but they just couldn't sell it. You know, they didn't think, or, you know, some had feedback here or there, and I would take it all in and, you know, do edits along the way. But I'm lucky enough to be with Distal, who's a really forward-thinking kind of agency. They're one of the few who's doing this now, where they have their own digital publishing program. They represent some of the biggest independent authors in the world, really. They've kind of recognized that this is a really growing area for the book industry, and they'd be kind of a fool not to, you know, to jump on it. And so they have a whole branch of the agency that handles independent authors, and they will help you. They'll help you polish everything up. They'll help you upload it, format it, and they'll help you do really important things like keywords for, you know, searches. So if somebody wants to read a mystery about a girl who kills somebody with a wine bottle and they're putting in all these things, they can find my book, you know, all these things that I wouldn't know how to do on my own. And they help with promotions and all these things. And so, and then you pay them the regular kind of 15% that you would pay anyway. So to me, it seemed like I had a good platform anyway with, you know, my career and my online life. I'm a huge oversharer. I say everything to everybody all the time, and I'm sort of out there. And they just still thought that my agents thought that I had the ability to kind of to try this digital publishing program and see how it goes. And what's happening is that a lot of their authors are doing this, and then they're getting publishing deals on the back end, and that's working out really well for a lot of people. So we decided to go for it, and I got Jennifer DeCamp, who used to work at the Times, to do my cover. She's a brilliant graphic artist, and I hired a copy editor, and it's, you know, it's all been done very professionally. It's just a little bit different than the traditional path. And so far it's been really fun and interesting. You know, I'm not unhappy that I went this way.
Well, and I got to point out that you and I are not the only ones in the St. Petersburg area who are represented by Distal and Goderich. They actually, I think, I don't know, a good percentage of their of the roster comes right out of the St. Pete Times. Tampa Bay Times, excuse me.
They knew a good thing when they see it.
Yeah, you know, or they just, I don't know, maybe they figured that they could retire here one day.
That could be.
If they know a lot of people, it'll make the...
They need a room for rent.
It'll make it easier one day. So it's interesting, I didn't realize this. You did not come to journalism through a traditional path.
No, not at all. Not at all. It's funny because we hire these interns at the Times, and they post their lives on the bulletin board, and it's like they're coming from Northwestern, and they're coming from Indiana, and they're, you know, Florida, and they've already been to China, and they speak three languages, and they've worked at six papers, and, you know, now they're going to cover the breaking news at 6 a.m, and I'm just like, whoa, I was literally working at the mall. Okay. I was getting an associate's degree in liberal arts. I had no idea how to write a newspaper story. No idea. And actually, I always tell people, I think that served me really well, and it helped me develop my voices, because I didn't know how a story was supposed to sound, you know? So I would just sort of wing it and like let my own personality come through and humor, and they would sneak into these little briefs that I would write for the paper, and then, you know, people would laugh, and then I would get to write a little bit bigger story, and it kind of just snowballed from there. And my sheer ignorance about journalism has really helped me to do well at it, and to kind of carve out a niche for myself that I don't know if I would have done if I had gone a traditional path. But yeah, I definitely have never had a fancy internship or anything like that. This has been it. Mall to career.
Well, it's what gives you that unique voice.
Yeah.
I know when I was in high school and I was thinking, well, maybe I wanted to, you know, I knew I wanted to be a writer. I didn't know that I wanted to be a journalist per se. And I got to know the people at the New Brunswick Home News in New Jersey. There was a reporter who would pick me up every week, and I would follow her around on the cop beat once a week. And the editor of the paper, who had gotten to know me through that, came to our high school for a career day when I was like a junior, and I took him aside and I said, "What should I do?" He said, "Whatever you do, don't study journalism." I said, "What?" He said, "You study journalism, you're going to wind up an editor or an academic or something." He says, "Go out there and learn something about life. Yeah. Study something else, get some real experience, and then come back around." And that kind of worked for me. I didn't work at the mall, but I worked a lot of different things, and you know.
The mall, I will tell you, is a great study in people watching and observation. There's no place better to do that than the mall. So it was training in its own way.
You see people. There's no doubt about that. And how long were you actually on the obituary beat?
I did that for about a year and a half. It was sort of, it's not anything that I wanted to do. It wasn't like I laid awake at night and dreamed of writing, you know, stories about dead people. But the Times was starting this job, and because we had been switching from paid obits to, or I'm sorry, to, from free obits to paid obits, right. And just kind of soften the blow of that, we wanted to offer, you know, a new feature for the obit page that readers could kind of count on. And they were starting this, and you know, I was approached. Did I want to try to interview for it? And I thought, I don't know, maybe, I don't know. And then I thought, you know, I started thinking about it some more, and I thought, well, I'd be a fool not to, because it's, you know, it was in the metro section. I was writing for a regional. It was full time. I was part time. It was daily writing. It was feature writing, which is, you know, what I really loved. And you know, it was a great opportunity, and like the dark death part of it was just one small aspect of it. So I kind of dived into the job, and I wrote a feature obit every day pretty much for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And I think I counted up to maybe 350 of them by the end. Yeah. And they were daily. I mean, you would come in the morning, you look at your little page of obits and you see who looks good, and you, you know, it might be someone with a lot of accolades and someone who did something really interesting, who was kind of a public figure, or it might be just an oddball little thing that would stand out to you, you know, somebody nobody knew about. And I would identify them in the morning and do the interviews throughout the day, and then write it on deadline for night. And we still have a writer, Andy Meacham, who does this now, who he and I have an interesting bond, because we're the only two who really know what this is like to do this on a daily deadline. So I did that for a year and a half, and I kind of just hit a wall. Andy's done it longer than me. Maybe he's got a darker sensibility than me and can do that. But after a year and a half, I kind of felt like, you know, I was like, I gained 15 pounds. I was thinking about death all the time. A song would come on in the car, and I would be like, oh, if I die, this would be nice at my funeral. And it was just got a little sick. So I needed to kind of step away, and my dog's shaking it out. And so I moved on to a different beat at the newspaper, and everyone was really helpful to have me do that. And, but really it was one of the greatest writing experiences of my life. And I don't just say that lightly. It was, I always called it aerobic feature writing, because I would have to do in a very small space, in a very short span of time, I would have to figure out a character, you know, carve out an arc of their life, and then really think about, you know, because I only had 12 to 14 inches usually to do them. So I would have to think about, well, what is this story really about? You know, and I'd have to figure that out in about 5 minutes. And that's not always easy. And what about this person can go, and what can stay? And it was extreme good training for the rest of my career, and for my fiction writing as well.
And you probably saw fewer dead bodies on that job than the police reporter did.
Yes.
Although, yeah, people think obituary, oh my God, you must be dealing with dead people. No, you're dealing with the memory of the dead people, but you're not.
Yeah, it's funny, because it's the only job in the world where you, the journalism job, where you physically cannot interview your subject. You know, a lot of times your subject won't talk to you, and that's a different challenge, but this is one where they cannot talk to you. And so the challenge is to reconstruct their life based on everybody else's memories. And as, I mean, I'm sure, as you know, like, you remember things about your mother-in-law that Mimi probably didn't, and vice versa, and everybody has a different view. And so it was kind of trying to find that common story in everybody's stories and tell it.
I remember those things that my wife likes me not to ever bring up.
Right, exactly. And that was a challenge too, because, you know, what I was writing, they weren't tributes. They were stories. They were newspaper stories. And it's not my job to make somebody appear perfect. You know, it's my job to tell a true story about them. And so that was always a challenge when people had done interesting things in their life, of explaining to the family that, you know, that those things had to be included as well.
You know, it's funny, at a time when newspapers obviously are suffering circulation issues and distribution issues, there are three things that the Times, this Times, Tampa Bay Times, has added to the paper that I think have made it that much more readable. One was, the first was when they brought you on to start doing real obituary stories, which made it interesting. Because I still read them. I read Andy's. I mean, I read yours because it was interesting. I'm always interested in people and character. So there was that. They added a strange thing, which I'm still surprised that I like, which was my first car, where readers would get a picture of the old car. Yeah, I think that would make a great website, and I've tried to share that. Nobody's taken me up on that. I think that would make a tremendous website. And then recently they started doing with weddings what they were doing with obituaries, which is the New York Times has made great hay out of that for years, just picking what sounded like an interesting wedding. You know, so
those stories.
Yeah, yeah, they're fun to read. You know, they take you into someone's life.
Them. It's you know, it's reminiscent of people's real lives. It's we need to know the news and. We need to be informed, but we also need to be reminded of our humanity and the things that kind of make us real people every day. And I think that's why those stories really connect. And the Times, we're really lucky. I'm really lucky to work at the Times that still recognizes the importance of that in storytelling.
Mm. Now, what kind of things, what kind of advice did you get, maybe from the people at Distel and Goderich, maybe elsewhere, to help you kind of separate the type of writing you do for the newspaper and writing a book, a novel like Obituary?
That's never been a struggle for me. It's kind of funny. I've talked to some other reporter friends and they said, I just feel like if I wrote a novel or started going into fiction, like I could never go back. Like that's what they think. It's this cliff that they'll fall over and like they won't be able to tell the truth anymore. And to me, that never felt like a challenge at all. You know, the fiction and the creativity and the artistic side has always been very natural to me. That's really where my heart was at the beginning of, you know, my life. And so for me, it was kind of a snap to go there. It was fun. It was, you know, I would take my little computer out at lunch and just sort of take my lunch hour and, you know, write 1,000 words and then come back and switch back into, you know, journalism mode. And for me, it was fine. And like I said earlier, when I was ignorant to the styles of journalism. And so it was my tone kind of, I think, is a little bit across the board. You know, I can definitely write a straight news story, but you can sense some of the tone in my book and some of my future stories and, you know, and vice versa. And so to me, it felt like a comfortable fit. I've gotten tons of advice over the years. I mean, everything I've learned from my colleagues at the Times. Honestly, I just... You know, I had a good, you know, college experience, but my immersion really came from the paper and the people around me. Kelly Benham is one of my big mentors, and her husband, Tom French, is also a Distel person. And
I've never heard of him. That name, what was
She's a dear close friend, but she's also been my most brutal editor. And so you'll give her something to read and it'll come back all marked up and crap. And, you know, you can do better and don't do that, you know. And I really need that personally. I need that to get better. I respond to that. And everything that she's told me, I take with me and I remember and I try not to do it again, you know. And so now I find myself taking the things that they've taught me and teaching it to other writers. And it's a really good feeling to kind of pass on that knowledge. But, you know, most of the journalists I know don't really dabble in fiction, so that was kind of a solitary pursuit, and I just sort of saw how it went and, you know, learned a lot. I learned a lot through my rejection letters, actually, with the fiction, because from agents and different people and publishers, because they don't know who I am. They have no interest in preserving my feelings. You know, they kind of just give it to you. They're always very polite. I had one that was not polite. I think everybody has one that was just kind of mean. But every, you know, the dozens of others were just friendly and they would give advice like they loved it. This is what they liked about it, but this is what wasn't working. And that would allow me to go. It was kind of a ongoing series of editors in a way. It would allow me to go back to the manuscript and kind of address what they were talking about and see if I agreed or disagreed and, you know, what I wanted to do about it. And I found that really helpful and hurtful at the same time. But once you kind of step away for a day, you can kind of go, okay, well, they're right. You know, first you're like, they don't know what they're talking about. They're out to get me. They don't have vision. And then you sleep and you're like, oh yeah, she was totally right. And then you can kind of go back and fix it. So that's been interesting for me and actually really helpful.
Was there any really horrendous advice that you got that you ultimately discarded, but you started to take?
Well, just some of them would get, that advice. Some of the meanest ones, they didn't feel like advice to me. They just felt like rudeness. Like one person called my character adorably impish or something like that. And I thought, hey, you're talking about me. And it didn't help me at all. Like, I couldn't totally reframe my character. You know, it wasn't anything that I was going to, that's just as like scrapper and start over. Whereas other people, most people who've read it just really respond to the character and like her. And for this person just didn't, and that's fine. That's going to happen. But that was pretty rude. I had all these fantasies about like starting. I'm like, I'm going to start my own publishing company called Impish Press, and you know, and I just own this thing and go with it. But of course, you know, let her sleep it off, and it's fine. But you know, most of the feedback has been really helpful, and they would say, you know, this part is overwritten, and then I would go back and I can, you know, I really need to edit kind of ruthlessly and take out things that, you know, that don't need to be there, and that helped me pare it way down. I mean, it was. I think when I finished the manuscript, it was way too long. It was 120,000 words, which is crazy for a book like this. And I've cut it down to 80, you know, over time. So, and that's not by cutting out any major plot changes. It was just like trimming the fat, you know, and I think it's just made a much tighter package, just like a newspaper story.
You take those 40,000 words you cut and you're halfway to your next book.
That's true.
Just got to kind of, you know, move them around a little bit.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So there's plenty of types in the book, the editor, the cops reporter, the mattress fortunaire. And I wondered, I don't know if you know a mattress fortunaire, but how hard did you work to disguise real people from the characters in the book?
Oh, well, it's funny because everybody, they'll read it and they'll go, is that so-and-so? Is that so-and-so? And I even got an email from my aunt the other day, and she was like, I just love all the family members that you portrayed. And I was like, no, I didn't. That's not what I was doing. What basically they are is there's no one person. The closest character to reality is Penny, who's based in myself. But the rest of the characters aren't based on any one person in reality. They're really composites of things that I see. And a lot of times, honestly, I'll be in... I was writing, there's a her friend at work, Mark, he's into 80s music, and I was writing one day in Borders, rest in peace, and I was just typing, and this song, Danger Zone, from Top Gun came into my head. And
Kenny Loggins.
And I just started singing it in my head, and I just started typing the words, and because why not? And then Mark became an 80s music freak, you know, and it was annoying Penny because he would sing out loud at his desk all day. Now, do I have coworkers who sing out loud at their desk all day? Sure, you know, but Mark's not based on that person, you know. They're little things that I observe, and that's the journalist in me, I think, is absorbing all these things that I observe and then putting them in my memory bank somewhere where I can draw from them. I can honestly say there is no character in this book fully based on one person. That's it's just not. The funny thing is the names, I used all these names, and my aunt pointed this out to me the other day about all these the family members she thought that I was writing about. And she'd had a list of like six names, and they were all somewhere from my family. And I had no idea that I did this, you know, and this was last week. This has been out for a while. And, she's like X, Y, and Z and this and that and that. And I'm like, oh my God, those are, you know, to the extent that one of the characters, the passing ancillary characters, is named Charles Pierre, and that is the name of my aunt's dead dog. That is a pretty specific name that I put in this book without even realizing. And I couldn't believe that I did this. And it's funny, there's two characters in the book, one named Ashley and one named Nicole. And those were my two best friends in childhood on my street. And the characters don't have anything to do with Ashley and Nicole, but those names, for some reason, stuck in my head, and I think they emerged on the page. And it's funny to go back and read it and see all these little subconscious things that come out. And you know, of course, there are some archetypes and of, you know, newspaper editors. And what I really wanted to do was, having worked in a newsroom for so long, I wanted to portray a newsroom that felt a little more real, you know, that didn't feel like a newsroom that you would see in a Katherine Heigl movie. Not that I don't love them and watch them all the time, but, you know, they're always, the newspaper editors always screaming and they're ripping things and running around. And it's really, I bring people for tours to the newsroom and I'm like, it's kind of insurance office-y and there's carpet and it's pretty quiet. And There's always, Penny goes through this experience where it's like, it's a deathly quiet in the newsroom. Nobody is talking because they're all doing whatever. They're out on assignments and you've got to make a really uncomfortable phone call and everybody's going to hear you. You know, everyone's going to hear every question you ask, every dumb boneheaded mistake you make on the phone. And there's this tension of like, do I pick up the phone? Do I not? And I wanted to kind of capture those real things that I've lived through that are more authentic to me than maybe what we see portrayed in other books or on TV and movies.
I was just thinking about that as you said it, and I was remembering moments when I worked in the Clearwater Bureau of the Times, and I was the music critic at the newspaper for a couple of years, and it would be dead silent, and I would be interviewing maybe a comedian or maybe like a heavy metal musician, and the questions you would ask those people are not like asking, you know, what the cops reporter would be asking, and I'd be sitting there, and Tim Nickens would be next to me, and it'd be dead quiet, and I would have to ask, I wish I could think of a great example of something I would ask, and everybody would suddenly just look over at me like, what the hell are you talking about today? So yeah, I mean, those moments of silence.
I worked in TBT for a couple of years where we did our entertainment stuff, and I would interview celebrities all the time. Like, one day the phone rang, and it was the rapper Lil Jon. He was like, hey, it's Lil Jon. I was like, you're interviewing Lil Jon in the middle of a quiet newsroom and asking him, you know, well, what was it like to write shots, you know? It's just like, is this real life? You know, it's very weird and surreal.
Well, let's stick with the come back to the names theme for a second. You mentioned Ashley, and I wanted to ask you, Ashley's last name, I wondered if that came from a Jeff Klinkenberg story or if that came out of thin air.
Ashley's last name is Sobczak.
Sobczak, yeah.
No, I'm Polish. That was just that's
interesting.
I'm from Lorain, Ohio, pierogi land of the world. Like, that was just one of those names that you hear around town. I don't know about.
Oh, okay. Well, I only know one Sobczak in town, and Klink had written about the family, so I wondered. It instantly clicked with me. So
no, yeah. Unless I read it and stored it in my hemisphere somewhere,
it's a memorable name, that's for sure. And then Buck Rogers Bigglesby, Buck Rogers, obviously Bigglesby. I don't know where that would come from, but Buck Rogers,
either.
I guess.
I don't really either.
And then you went with a long-standing tradition of for your own character, Penny Perkins, Lois Lane, the most famous, the double, the LL, the PP.
Yeah. I think I had her like Penny Green or something for a while. And I just wanted something a little snappier, something more memorable. And I love alliteration. My writing is full of it. You can always, you know, point it out. I probably rely on it too much, but I just think there's something really memorable and kind of, you can kind of hold on to that name, you know. If it is a series, you're going to know who Penny Perkins is, and it's not a challenging name, but it's a fun name. It's got some personality, but it's not. I always hate when I read a book and it's like, you know, Dusty Featherwind or some sort of funky new kind of unisex name. I just wanted her to be a girl, you know, a girl in the world. And I thought that was a very girl in the world kind of name that people could remember.
Well, and I think if Lou Grant were here, he would definitely say that Penny Perkins had spunk.
She does have spunk.
Now, one of the things, before we were talking about the writing, one of the things you deal with in the book that is different than what you would deal with writing for a newspaper is there is Penny's sexuality, there is sex talk. And I wondered, what was the response of people in the newsroom for the first time when they read you writing this stuff, or family? Because it's one thing to go from, you know, writing news stories that people read, and it's like, okay. But then when you have to write something that's sexual in a book, suddenly people are getting a little, you know, you're kind of pulling aside.
Right.
The, yeah.
A little different line that you cross at work normally. Yeah, and I, you know, I'm nervous to write about that stuff too. And there's sex themes throughout the book, but they're more comical. There's one, you know, sex scene, and even that is very light and funny, and it's not. And I even thought, do I need this? But it's actually really pivotal to a plot point in the book. You know, it's a way for Penny to get something that she needs, and so I had to have it in there, and not that way, in a different way.
I know. It's just funny the way you said it.
Yeah, I know. You know, and but ultimately, I just decided I couldn't worry too much about that. You know, any great art that you make is not going to be perfectly censored, you know, and something that necessarily your great grandmother would want to see. It's like, if I did that, I would be doing a disservice. And to me, it's kind of funny because some people don't like the language in the book. I cleaned up a lot of it. I tried to make it feel authentic again. I mean, newsrooms are full of cursing, and this is how people talk. And I one of the letters that I got from one of these publishers said that they just didn't think the audience could handle that, you know, that kind of thing, the audience for this sort of mystery genre. And most people have been fine with it. I got one review on Amazon that said she had her Kindle reader, so she had it read out loud to her, and she, you know, she said if she was reading them over herself, she could skim, but she couldn't take it with the language with the Kindle reader. So it was very nice. She was just, you know, she's like, if this is not your thing, just, you know, here you go. So I got a couple, you know, reactions to that end. But it's funny for me, you know, I watch Girls on HBO, and that's just about as crazy far out language and sexuality as you can get. And to me, but it feels very real to me, you know. And I wanted to approach it in a way that felt real, not as extreme as Girls, but in a way that, you know, acknowledged how real people are these days and what, you know, entertainment we're consuming. I didn't want it to be totally sterile, because people are not that way. And I think that, you know, my journalist friends understand that. I don't think anybody is too pearl clutchy about it. And, you know, it hasn't been any big scandal so far. It's not like, it's not 50 Shades of Grey.
No. And I don't mean to suggest that it is. And, you know, if there wasn't cursing in a book that takes place in a newsroom, I wouldn't have found it to be real. I mean, I'm married to a newspaper editor who curses like a sailor.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
I know where she learned it.
Exactly.
It wasn't at home.
Yeah, almost if you don't curse around the newsroom, it's like, what's wrong with you? Why are you so calm? It's kind of normal.
You know, keep calm and keep cursing.
Yeah.
Well, so are you? Do you see potential to do another Penny, a series of Pennies? What would trigger another story for you?
I would love to. I'm actually working on the second one now. I'm a fair chunk into it. I need to keep going. My hope is to get it out maybe this time next year, because this book was just released about 3 or 4 weeks ago. So if I can, you know, do one a year, I think that would be a really good clip. You know, in a good pace for readers. And I think, you know, I've started two other books that have nothing to do with Penny, and they're okay, and I kind of pluck away at them, but then I keep going back to Penny, and I just kind of light up when I go to that. And I feel like that's a good instinct to listen to. You know, if I feel continually compelled to create her, I should. And people have asked for it already. I mean, people are reading it and they want to know when the next one's coming. And so, you know, we have the premise. She's in the second one, she's going to go undercover at this Hooters style restaurant called Wingman's and investigate the disappearance of one of the girls there. And she's going to kind of explore what it's like to work at a place like that. And so that's kind of where we're working right now. And she's been, well, I won't give too much away because I don't want to give away the end of this book. But so it's definitely in the works, and I definitely want to make this a series for sure.
I can just imagine where the book launch party will be. it helps that Hooters is headquartered right here in town. As we kind of wind down, the Times, the Tampa Bay Times, formerly the St. Petersburg Times, for people out of the area who haven't caught up on that, it has produced a tremendous number of Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters and even more book authors. And I'm just kind of wondering if there is something in the air at 490 First Avenue South that is not present perhaps at other newspapers.
I can't answer that because I haven't worked at any other newspapers. This has been my whole life, and I'm grateful for that. But I do know what is present, and what is present is, you know, a real commitment to bring readers news and stories that they care about, but also a commitment to creativity and letting people, you know, come in with an idea and talk through it and turn it into something great. I mean, I think that we're one of the few papers that will still let a feature reporter work on something for a year, you know, and turn it into a really wonderful project. And, you know, we'll let yesterday on the front page, we had a feature story about a kid, Lane DeGregory's story about a kid cutting his hair. And that kind of story wouldn't appear in a lot of newspapers, a lot of daily newspapers anymore. It's just the reality of the business. And we just maintain this commitment to real writing, to real storytelling, to real creativity, and letting the writers kind of figure out who they are and how that can best serve the paper. And, you know, letting them be individuals and not try to write like everybody else. And I think that's a really special thing. And, you know, when you're around that many cool people, I think just good ideas come out, you know, good things happen, and we help each other. And you're just constantly inspired if you're always, you know, working on things that are interesting and amazing. And I don't think that I would have really had any kind of career as a fiction writer if I hadn't worked at the newspaper and seen everything that I've seen and done everything that I've done and learned all that I've learned. And it's just really integral to anybody who wants to write good stories to really absorb real life. And that's what we do every day at the paper. And it just fosters a lot of wonderful creations, I think.
All right. Last question, in the spirit of Penny Perkins. What wine, beer, or mixed drink would go best with an unhurried read of Obituary?
That's an interesting. I used to drink a lot of juice wine in college, but now I find it too sweet. My go-to would be a Pinot Grigio, I think, now. Not too challenging, but not too sweet. I think that's what Penny is.
Got it. Not too challenging. Just a bit. Okay. And on that note, folks, you can find Obituary. And let me spell it just so we're clear here. I'm not just making fun with words here. It's Obituary.
So, yeah.
Oh, they'll trust me. They'll have seen it many times by now. I just wanted to say it again. So, and it is spelled with B-I-T-C-H in the middle. It's written by my guest right here, Stephanie Hayes, and it's in great stores everywhere, we hope, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. If you're watching the video, the book cover is right below us, kind of over to the right there. You can just click on it right now. It'll take you to Amazon. You can have the book instantly if you order it for your Kindle, or you can have it as soon as tomorrow if you order it in print. Steph, you have the website. You have your blog, which is stephinfections.com.
Yeah. stephinfections.com, like staph infections. Most of my Google hits come from people searching how to cure their staph infections. So it's real easy to find.
All right. And it's STEPH infections.com. Are you on Twitter, Facebook, any of that other stuff?
Yeah, I'm on all of it. I'm on Twitter all the time, Steph Hayes. And on stephinfections.com, you can link to all my social media as well. And yeah, feel free to follow me and talk to me. I try to talk to everybody who talks to me and engage with them. And I love to meet new people. And I would love to meet you too. So yeah, drop me a line.
Very nice. All right. Well, Stephanie Hayes, author of Obituary. congratulations on the book. Great start to another facet of the career. And thanks for joining us today on Mr. Media.
Thank you so much.
Almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest 2-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority, for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening.